Welcome, everybody, for your weekly walk through the wilderness with your personal guide, the Pilgrim on the 405. Here he is, professional sales trainer, Will Crist.
Well, good afternoon on this wonderful day in Laguna Beach. I've been traveling up the 405 back and forth, listening and talking. We met with a great CEO this afternoon who's going to be on the show in a couple of weeks. Turnaround artist, has been working for the past 20 years in helping companies enhance their vision, change what they're doing, become whole again, and make progress, increase their revenue, and increase their scope around the globe. Hal Reisinger will be with us in a couple of weeks, president of Cosgrove Americas. But today we're going to be talking with a fellow who has 17 years' experience of protecting executives, medium to large companies, protecting executives from unfavorable equipment leasing agreements and loan transactions. He's, you know, what he's really doing is helping these C-level executives protect themselves from unforeseen, unexpected, unfavorable financial surprises. What C-level executive in a medium to large-sized business would not like to be able to sleep easier at night knowing that at least one portion of his or her business was invulnerable to surprises, unfortunate financial surprises? So we're going to talk with Jay Zeinfeld today as the president and CEO of the Optimist Group, and we're going to hear some stories from Jay. So, you know, what do they say on television sometimes? This might not be suitable for children. So we might have some horror stories about what's happened in contractual agreements and also what's happened in leasing agreements. And sometimes, as Jay will tell us, we even have predatory leasing companies that prey on companies that just are not paying attention. So let's sit back and take a listen to what stories that Jay Zeinfeld from the Optimist Group is going to tell us today. So Jay, welcome to the Pilgrim on the 405.
Well, thank you, Will.
Tell us a little bit about the Optimist Group and how you help unsuspecting C-level officers of companies protect themselves from these unforeseen, unexpected, unfortunate financial surprises.
Well, Will, today, I think more than any time in our country's history, you need to be an expert, you need to be a confidant in just about everything that you do today. And leasing is one of those areas. And where we help the C-level executive is by closely examining their contracts, the lease structures, and the companies they're doing business with. Because quite frankly, many of them have put their guard down. They've been referred to leasing companies either by the equipment provider, and so therefore they have a false sense of security that the equipment provider has vetted the leasing company. They may have been referred to the leasing company by their banker, and again, assuming that the vetting has been done for them. And so what we'll do is we will sit with the C-level executive, have them select a material lease, have them describe to us, you know, what they think the structure is, how it terminates, and what options they have, and then we will replay to them what the actual language is. And I would estimate that more than 90% of the time, there is a large conflict of interest between what the documents say and what the C-level executive thinks they're obligated to pay.
90% of the time?
I would say closer to 100, but that wouldn't be believable. But I would say in our last 20 years that it's in excess of 90%.
Well, Now, do you think that is because C-level executives don't understand how to read a lease?
I would probably be a little more gracious than that. But I would say the C-level executive is obviously very busy. And unless leasing is strategic to their company, they most likely have delegated the responsibility elsewhere in the company. And very few people outside of the equipment leasing business know how to understand lease contracts and the lease economics. So I would say yes, politely, that many of the C-level executives do not understand the detailed aspects of leasing, the true economics, and where the costs are buried.
All right. So is that do you think that I'm a little aghast. I'm a little surprised. Now, is leasing a significant, when we talk about unfortunate surprises, financial surprises, can that be expensive to a company?
It is. If one takes a look at a typical transaction, whether it's a $10,000 copier lease, whether it's a $100,000 tractor lease, whether it's a $1 million MRI or a $10 million aircraft, the statistics that we have in our database tend to run in parallel, regardless of the size of the transaction. And what we typically see is there is anywhere from 15 to over 30% of the transaction size in additional costs unplanned by the C-level executive.
15 to 30%. Now, in a typical business that you work with, a medium to large business, what could be the scope of their leasing that we're going to take this 15 to 30%?
Most of our customers are capital equipment intensive. And so on the low end, they may lease $5 million a year in equipment. On the high end, it can exceed $50 million. But take your typical, mid to large company that's capital equipment intensive, say they lease $10 million a year. That means that those $10 million that they've leased on any given year will have about $1.5 million or above in unplanned expenses sometime throughout that lease term. And as this accumulates year after year after year, you will quickly get into the many millions.
Well, all right. So let's talk about some stories here. Tell us some stories about we'll do some. Tell me some where there were some horror stories, and maybe we'll also get into some a little later on where there were some good outcomes. But tell us some typical examples of what happens when these leases are not, when somebody doesn't pay attention to their leasing portfolio.
Well, here's an example. A major law firm, international in scope, offices all around the world, for various reasons, decided to lease not only their technology, but also decided, because they thought the terms were very advantageous, to also lease drapes, carpet, drywall, basically you name it, whatever the lessor would allow them to put on a lease, they put on a lease. And they were going very happily along their way, until they started to get towards the end of the lease, and then one of their financial analysts was charged with estimating what their options were and what the costs were going to be if they wanted to start exercising these options. Very quickly, this analyst got a little overwhelmed and a little concerned with what he was reading. We helped him in this review, and what we found out, closely looking at the documents, that they basically had a provision that cross-tied every lease that they ever wrote with this leasing company over the prior 3 years, which was in total over $10, $12 million. One decision made was to apply to every lease and every asset under that schedule, meaning if you wanted to buy one item out of the thousands of items under lease, you had to buy everything under every lease. If you wanted to return one item, you had to return everything under that lease. So they quickly found out that there was a mishmash of items that they wanted to buy, some they wanted to return, Some they would like to upgrade. Some they'd like to extend. So then when they came to the knowledge that they're going to have to purchase, because how do you return drywall? Then we looked further into their documents and found that there was no stated purchase price. Just this very nebulous, mutually agreeable price based upon their appraised value of what everything would be worth if a comparable firm were to use these assets in a comparable way. Now, I know that's really hard to understand, but based upon the economics, they were looking at close to a 45% balloon based upon the original cost, and they had budgeted nowhere near that. They budgeted more in the 10 to 15% range because they were of the belief that they wouldn't have to pay for drywall, that they wouldn't have to be replacing used equipment and paying different prices for it. So they were quite shocked, and so that would be one horror story.
Well, now, in that story, did you catch it in time, or did this in fact happen?
What we caught in time for them was there was a trigger clause. Most leases today, particularly for operating leases, requires that the lessee notify the leasing company 30, 60, 90, upwards of 180 days in advance of lease expiration, which end-of-term option you're electing. Failure to give this written notice to the leasing company defaults into a decision of automatic renewal. And so what we were able to do for them was we pointed out this clause, which required a 180-day prior written notice. Had they failed, the lease would have renewed for a year. And so by giving that notice, they were able to avoid the automatic or forced renewal of 1 year, which removed a lot of leverage from the leasing company's perspective in negotiating the price. Then we were able to help them formulate offers and counteroffers, introduce them to appraisers that could appraise the various assets, help them calculate how much return the lessor would be willing to accept, and come up with a good settlement for them.
That could have been at 45%, that could have been a significant surprise, huh?
It was, several million, and with a little bit of relationship leverage, with a little bit of chutzpah, and some good analysis behind it, the client was able to save several million dollars.
Wow. And that would be right to the bottom line, wouldn't it?
Right to the partner's bottom line.
Wow.
And as you probably know, not all law firms today, while there's many law firm jokes and they're accused of making obscene dollar amounts, many of them are hurting today.
Oh, well, that would be one firm that would have been hurting a lot.
Yes.
All right, so I'll strap on my seatbelt here, and let's get ready for the next horror story.
Well, the next one was a pilot project that a client wanted to start with us to see if they, one, could benefit from our services, and two, you know, whether they needed our services. And so they gave us a small number of telephone leases to take a look at. They leased equipment by asset category, and they had someone responsible for each of the various assets. So they had an IT manager, a telecom manager, a forklift manager, so on and so forth. And so we were given 35 leases to look at. Number one, they didn't have copies of all their documents, so we had to go out and do a search and discovery with their leasing companies to get copies of the documents. So one, we found a deficit in their audit process and document retention process. So we fixed that for them. Number two, we identified 12 of the 35 leases that were in an automatic renewal phase, meaning they failed to notify the leasing company per the terms of the contract in advance that they wanted to either buy, return, or extend the lease, and the default election for not giving notice is extension. One of the leases was originally a 5-year lease term, and it was about an $800,000 phone system. Because they failed to give notice, the lease went into an automatic renewal phase. That renewal phase, by the time we audited their leases, had gone on 7 additional years beyond the 5-year lease term. to make
seven additional years?
Seven. It's a total term now of 12 years.
Wow.
Now, to make matters even worse, is that they no longer had that particular location. They had closed down that location a few years earlier. So there was no one there to even be watching for these types of expenses, because leases just went to a different part of the company and paid those expenses directly until they were told not to. So when this was brought to their attention, they asked us to reach out to the leasing company, which we did. We told them, you know, what's going on. The leasing company was aware. The leasing company then said, well, since this lease is so old, do you want to return the equipment or do you want to buy it? And then, you know, we thought in good faith that we should let them know that the equipment is no longer at that location, because the terms of a lease requires that the leasing company be notified if the equipment's been moved. The leasing company then, you know, said, well, wait a minute, our equipment isn't there anymore. Where is our equipment? And we had to honestly tell them that no one knows. So then they came back and said, well, we have a problem here. We either have an insurance claim or a potential default situation. Uh-huh. But either way, if that equipment was there, since we're good guys, we're only going to charge you 35% of the original cost of the equipment.
Oh, my goodness, 35% of equipment that 7 years ago disappeared.
So here the customer paid for the equipment 2.5 times over, and now they want an additional 35%. So we were able to reason with the leasing company and allowed the customer to, you know, walk away with no further obligation, account closed based upon the 12 years worth of rents.
Well, now, these are surprises that without you, they would just bubble up at some point. Is that right?
You know, we always like to think sooner or later a red flag occurs and someone sees it and puts an end to it. But, yes, I think this is something that would have continued until some catalyst, whether it be us or someone else in the company, would have identified it.
Do you think that that would ever affect a CFO's job?
The size of this particular firm, no. I mean, to me as an individual, an $800,000 lease with $250,000 buyout is a large sum of money. To a multi-billion dollar organization with multiple locations, in this particular case, no. But I have seen in companies that are $100 million to $200 million in revenue where, yes, $1 million error or oversight could be problematic. I mean, we've seen situations where the customer cannot come up with the balloon payment, must have the equipment, has to go out and get new financing to pay for the balloon. But what happens if they're not in the position to get the new financing? We have seen situations where very large leases and large lease disputes can force a bankruptcy.
A bankruptcy, not just firing the CFO, but a bankruptcy for the whole company.
Yeah, most CFOs, I think, would be insulated from being fired unless, I think, there was discovery of fraud or, you know, true lack of competency. But that's, I think, going to be pretty rare. I think most of the time, you know, it's a strange thing with CFOs. Their tenure with companies don't tend to be very long. They tend to be transient. We see many CFOs, you know, staying 5 years or less. And so they could write a lease, they can move on to another job assignment, a new CFO takes over the responsibility, and so that whole chain of responsibility is no longer there.
So if I'm the CEO of a company and the new CFO comes, do I expect that he is going to be up to speed on every lease in my leasing portfolio?
If that's your expectation, I think you're going to be disappointed as the CEO.
So this is really not necessarily a CFO issue. This is a CEO issue.
If you have material leases, it is. For instance, recently we were engaged by a hospital and new CEO, and fortunately the CEO had had a bad experience at a prior job assignment. And so one of the first things that he charged his CFO and the finance team with was giving him a summary report of all outstanding equipment leases, whether it was a postage machine or whether it was an MRI. And so the CFO quickly realized that their legal library did not contain all of their lease documents. So when the report came back to the CEO with all of these deficiencies, you know, we were quickly hired to vet all these items out.
So I was thinking that maybe it would be the CFO's job if there was this surprise, that it would be a CFO whose job would be in jeopardy. But what I'm hearing now is it would be the CEO, because because regardless of where the surprise came from, it would have a direct impact on the bottom line of that company. That's where the board of directors is going to get a little upset.
Correct. And in fact, in this particular instance, the board of directors was brought in, because in our diligence in reviewing the existing leases, one of their lessors was one of those predatory leasing companies that have terms and conditions designed to extract as much money from a customer as possible, and they had three of them. And there was a very large surprise waiting for them. And this hospital, like many hospitals, are under a lot of stress financially. And so our recommendation was accepted by the board, and they did use an investment account that they had that was, you know, yielding very low returns, and decided to use those funds to early terminate the lease to avoid the problem. Yes, they had to pay out probably more than they would have liked to the leasing company, but the alternative was to pay even more down the road. And I credit the CFO and CEO for having the vision to take their lumps today, which would have been less than taking bigger lumps down the road.
Let me ask a question. Out of all the companies that ask you to come in and take a look at their leases, what percentage of them are, what shall we say, squeaky clean?
In 20 years, we've not seen the squeaky clean.
You mean that every company that you have worked with was vulnerable?
Was vulnerable in the at least 15% range of what they had under lease. Now, it's skewed towards companies with operating leases as opposed to capital leases. Capital leases are structured more like a term loan, which tend to be a more straightforward proposition. It's when you're based heavily in the operating lease realm that you're more likely to have these large surprises.
Tell me what an operating lease. Now, I understand that the term loan is like a capital lease is like a term loan, and an operating lease would be?
The term operating lease can be used in several ways. Operating lease can be used for tax purposes. So under a operating lease for tax purposes, the leasing company is the tax owner of the asset and therefore entitled to receive many benefits, including depreciation write-off. The borrower or the lessee, the customer, is entitled to deduct the lease payment. However, the lease term cannot be more than 75% of the useful life of that asset. So therefore, if you think about it from a common sense perspective, if the lease term is 75% of the useful life, that means at the end of the lease term, you're still going to need that asset. And so you're going to end up wanting to buy that asset in most cases, unless it's maybe IT equipment. But most other equipment categories, you're going to want to buy it to be able to get the last, you know, few months, couple years of life out of that asset. So under an operating lease, the most traditional end-of-term purchase option is what's called fair market value. And there are many ways to determine fair market value, and I can tell you in most cases it's not always very fair. So that's one way, one area where there's a lot of disagreement. You know, you can take a look at, in fact, I can give you a personal story. We moved our office about 4 years ago, the furniture that we had was probably 7 to 8 years old at the time. And so in this move, we were debating, well, should we, you know, have the moving company deinstall, deliver, reinstall this furniture that's 7 years old, 8 years old, or should we just go out and buy new equipment? Well, we called a couple people, and they basically said, well, look, we'll take the furniture from you for free. We'll remove it for free. We won't give you anything for it, but we won't charge you for it. So what we saw was the value of this furniture was worthless. However, the landlord, in showing our space, said they have a prospective tenant. The prospective tenant is interested in our furniture. They want to be able to move in day one and get rolling and go right to work, and wanted to know if we would sell our furniture. In the leasing world, that's called in-place fair market value. They were willing to give us almost 100% of what we paid for that equipment, the furniture, 7 to 8 years after the fact. Now, in a distress sale, or from the other vendor who's willing to give us nothing, there's a big discrepancy. And most lease documents today, by the way, are written with the fair market value in place language. So they calculate the value of your equipment as though it's working, functioning, producing revenue for the user, not just what you would get inside an auction house.
Wow. Now, when you are asked to look at a lease beforehand, can you get that changed?
In most cases, if you aren't too far down the road, and particularly if you are a financially strong company, yes, either you will get it changed by the lessor that's proposing, or if they don't agree to alter the language, you'd go to another lessor. That's why it's really important for people to know their financial strength and what their borrowing capacity is. Because if you're a strong credit, there's a very small number of leasing companies. While there may be close to 3,000 leasing companies today, there's probably less than 10 in this entire country that can truly service you with the right lease structure, with the right pricing, and with the right documentation sophistication to rewrite the documents to your favor.
Wow. Well, listen, Jay, we've only begun to talk about some of these stories. Can you spend a little more time with us?
I certainly can.
Well, we're going to take a break, short break right now, and hear from the guys over at Sandler Training, and then we'll be right back to, I want to hear some more of these stories. So we'll be right back after a word from the folks over at Sandler.
Hi, I'm Bob Barber with Sandler Training. I'm here to talk to you about rule number 6. Don't buy back tomorrow what you sold today. I was talking to a salesperson the other day, and he'd closed a big deal. Gone to the bank, cashed the check, the works. Unfortunately, he got a 4 o'clock in the morning phone call from a prospect saying, put a hold on things, something's come up. He'd had second thoughts. Second thoughts. Have you ever had second thoughts? Of course you have. It's human nature. It's usually right after you let your daughter stay out late on Friday night, or you order dessert or buy that new car. Did I make the right decision? It's only human nature. Traditional salespeople tend to rush through that process, hope that the person doesn't have their human nature natural reaction of second thoughts or buyer's remorse. They try to close the deal, pass that problem on to somebody else, get that contract processed. At Sandler, we help the prospect embrace that. Bring it up. Help them go through it. Work through that second thought, that buyer's remorse. It might sound something like, Jim, I'm looking forward to working with you. I think it's going to be fun. This accounting solution is what your company needs. Now, you were a little concerned that we couldn't get the conversion in place within 3 weeks. It's going to be more like 5. Are you going to be okay with that? Help that person work through it. What better way to reinforce the role of a trusted advisor than to help that person work through their buyer's remorse? Rule number 6, don't buy back tomorrow what you sold today.
Okay, we've been talking with Jay Zeinfeld of the Optimist Group about some of the horror stories that are facing some of the CEOs of medium to large companies, and they're not very pretty. So, Jay, tell us another story. I've got my popcorn here, and I'm braced for it.
Sure. There's a relatively new client of ours that is about to put the finishing touches on a lease for a line of credit for $10 million for some manufacturing equipment. The CFO believes that they have a two-year line of credit, much like a bank line of credit, and after the equipment is delivered and installed, which they're anticipating for this line of equipment, it's going to take about 2 years, then it turns out into an operating lease. Well, when we take a look at the language that's in there, number one, he is correct. He does have 2 years to have this product line installed and working. What he may not know, and in fact he doesn't know, is that the interest rate during that 2 year, every time they draw down on this equipment lease line of credit, the interest rate is close to 50%.
What?
Now, it's not stated in the document because obviously you don't have to be a C-level executive to think that 50% is too much. It's formulaic. It's buried in the language. And so you have to understand lease economics to be able to calculate these amounts. Number two, there's a make-whole agreement. It isn't just a $10 million line that he can use at his discretion. He has to fully utilize the $10 million. So if he falls short, there's a make-whole agreement for every dollar that he does not use up to the full $10 million.
So that make-whole agreement means that he's got to pay for money that he may not have wanted to use.
Correct. And it's a fairly common feature under bank lines of credit or term loans where, you know, they have a non-utilization fee. But this goes well beyond a customary non-utilization fee.
Did you discover this in time?
We're in the process of working through options right now. So probably don't want to talk too much more about that, but wow, we're in the process of seeing what can be done.
Well, at these levels, that's a significant hit to the bottom line then, isn't it?
It is. This is a company that has a new product line, going to be very successful, but not successful enough to overcome a nearly 50% interest rate over the next couple years, let alone the balloon payment that they didn't believe they had.
Wow.
So, yes, this would be a situation that if they are forced, and they may be, unfortunately, legally and maybe even morally required to go forward with their deal. This will be something that they're going to have to contend with down the road where they won't have the cash for the balloon payment, and they will be in the situation of having to borrow, most likely, to pay off the lease at the end.
Well, now let me ask a question here. The CEO signed the lease, right?
CFO signed the lease.
Did they understand what they were signing?
No. If I were to believe their recounting of what they thought they had agreed to and line that up with what the terms of the contract say, these are two entirely different transactions.
Is that nefarious on the part of the leasing company? Was that a misunderstanding or was that something else?
I would say from the lessor's perspective, it was a failure to disclose material deal points. From the lessee's perspective, it was a failure on their part to understand the intricacies of what they're signing. And my experience with many courts, though I'm not an attorney, and this isn't legal advice, that many of them would say that you are a sophisticated borrower, that you should have hired competent counsel, you're not a ma-and-pa, you know, business.
Right.
And that, you know, you should be aware.
Well, all right. Now, I don't want to get into your fees or anything, but if somebody had said, Jay, I've got this term document here for this lease, would you come and take a look at the term document and then the lease itself Would that have been exorbitantly expensive?
No, obviously, you know, I'm very proud of not just the service, but the fees that we charge. And our clients, I think, would say that there's a great deal of value. And the reason I know that is our clients, you know, re-engage us year after year after year. So, no, I would say there would have been a very good return on their investment.
Well, Jay, why don't we have CEOs lining up? Why isn't your phone always ringing with, come over here, we're getting ready to make a lease, we'd like to just pass it by you? Why doesn't that happen?
Leases aren't taken seriously, from my experience, by the corporate consumer. Unless it's a large transaction, meaning a corporate aircraft or a vessel, then they'll bring in their legal counsel, their general counsel most likely. But most of the experts in leasing, whether it be lawyers or finance and tax people, work for the leasing industry because they
what?
Take it very seriously.
They work for the leasing industry?
Well, for instance, we had a Fortune 50 client. I don't want to give their name without their permission, but we had a Fortune 50 company that was looking at a very large install for a distribution center. They had been burned on a lease in the past, and they had sworn off leasing for quite a long period of time, but they had financial reasons why now they wanted to start leasing in a large way. So when we met with them to talk about different things that they could do to protect themselves as well as get a competitive advantage in the marketplace, one of our suggestions was for them to write their own lease document and then have the lease providers that they select to sign their document versus them signing the leasing company's document. One, you're assuring yourself that the terms are fair and that they're going to be uniformed across the players. That way you have apple-to-apple comparison amongst the various lease providers. They asked us to do that for them. We told them no. We thought that, you know, they would be better served with either their in-house counsel or their outside third-party counsel, of which they had many law firms that they work with. A few weeks later, we got a call from them saying, no, we'd really like you guys to do it. And we said, why? We're telling you to use your lawyers. They said, because our law firm represents too many leasing companies and we feel there's a conflict of interest. And so did they.
This sounds to me a little bit like what happens in residential real estate, that the broker is really there for the seller, not necessarily for the buyer.
I would agree. You know, the best, we often say the best leasing rep, and I mean that in the greatest sense, the best leasing rep working for the best leasing company in the country has a fiduciary responsibility to its employer and their shareholders.
Not to the lessee.
Not to the lessee. Now, that doesn't mean all leasing reps and all leasing companies are trying to take advantage of their customer base.
Well, but it does mean that the lessee needs to take responsibility for what they're signing.
That I agree 100% with, and I can tell you a number of reasons and why. Number one,
right.
Leasing, just like real estate, your mortgage most likely has been sold 1, 2, 3, 4 times throughout its life. So you may have originally signed up with Bank A, who then sells it to financial institution B, C, D, and E throughout the life of your mortgage. Leasing, very similarly, has syndication groups that you originate the deal today with Will. Great guy, honest guy, wonderful guy, served you well. Will's company may sell it to another company. They now are responsible for enforcing the terms. While Will was in charge, he treated you fairly. In fact, he treated you more than fairly, and that's why you gave him his business. But now Will's company decided to sell it to another party. Will no longer influences how the leases are going to be enforced. This happens regularly in the leasing business.
Wow. So using a leasing agent that I trust might work. I might be able to live with how he would treat the terms of that lease for me, but I no longer have access to him if it's been sold two or three, even if it's been sold once, right?
Just once. And once, by the way, is the most common. You know, you can split a lease up in a couple different ways, but typically it's sold once.
Don't tell me it gets into securitization.
They can be sold into a pool, a securitization pool, yes.
Oh, my gosh. So it's even more important that every CEO takes a look at that lease through the eyes of an expert.
Because, absolutely, your one lease schedule can be part of a 1,000 lease pool, and your one lease, even though the leasing company relationally wants to help you, they can be somehow hamstrung because of the way it's been financed.
All right, so that's one reason that people should, I mean, that C-level, CFO, CEO should be looking at those leases and maintaining their portfolio with my goodness, with that's a valuable piece of their documentation. So that's one reason, number one, because the lease could be sold or will be sold. What's number two?
Number two is plans for equipment change. We're blessed with many very smart professionals that we work with within our clients. But I can tell you their crystal ball is not always perfect. So when they buy equipment today and they've done all of the ROI analysis as to why they're buying this equipment, why, what they're going to do with it, how long it's going to last, I can tell you the new widget is going to come out sooner. It's going to be shinier. It's going to do more things. It's going to do more things faster, better, and cheaper than the widget that you already have under lease. And you're going to need to modify that lease agreement somewhere during the lease term. And one of the quiet little secrets of leasing is there's a sentence in every lease that I've ever read, and it's called the hell or high water clause. Basically, the lease is a non-cancelable agreement. So if you signed a 5-year lease, you're in it for 5 years. If you want to get out, the lease is either silent or it's governed by the hell or high water clause. What most lessees, meaning the consumer, doesn't know is that that language can be negotiated to allow for technological changes, obsolescence, upgrades, replacements, but you have to know to ask for it, and you have to know the language because it will not be volunteered by the leasing company.
This sounds sort of like a cell phone agreement.
I'm only laughing because I'm going through this right now with my teenage son. So, yes, we have a 2-year contract, and he's, I think, 11 or 12 months into it, and we need to replace his phone. So I should have probably hired someone to to negotiate the document for me.
Uh-huh. All right. So one reason that C-level people in the company who are responsible for that company and incidentally responsible for the jobs in that company, right? If the company goes bankrupt, all those people lose their jobs.
And, you know, we've often talked to our customers because, you know, when a company gets large, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, sometimes it's just a rounding error and we lose sight of the dollars. And so we try to talk to them in terms of, yes, I know, it may only be a few hundred thousand dollars here or there, but, you know, how much does your company contribute to charity? Could that be somebody's job? Could that be somebody's bonus? And, you know, we try to make the number become more real.
Uh-huh. All right. So one is, one reason they need to be looking, not necessarily you, but somebody like you, right? They
Correct.
Need to be looking through your eyes or somebody like yours' eyes, because the lease is going to be sold without any question. It's going to be sold to somebody you don't know, and it could be securitized. All sorts of things can happen, and you lose control of it. Number two, it's because of the hell or high water clause. You might want to change equipment, right?
Correct.
Number three,
reputation. Leasing is a cottage industry. Everybody knows everybody, and everybody knows who you're doing business with. And in fact, there are databases that most leasing companies subscribe to that'll say, okay, I want to look up ABC Inc. I can find out who they're leasing through because leasing companies will file a UCC with the jurisdiction where the company is located. When they take a look at the different leasing companies they're doing business with, that will breed repetition of the same level leasing company. So, for instance, if you're doing business with a second or third tier leasing company, one being the best, so if you're working with a broker or one of these predatory lessors that has a bad reputation, but obviously you don't know they have a bad reputation because you went through business with them, when the leasing companies look at who you're doing business with, the good leasing companies may say, oh, here's a good opportunity for us to come in and really help things. Or they may say, this must be a bad credit, or this must be kind of shaky, so maybe we should stay away. But even worse, when the other Tier 2 and Tier 3 players see that you're working with Tier 2 and Tier 3 players, they feel that they have a chance to do business with you. Really, you need to be working with Tier 1s if you're a big, strong company with a large CapEx budget. So again, the other reason is it's going to be repetition of the same tier or class of leasing company.
Okay. All right. So what I'm beginning to hear is that these nasty surprises are there because somebody didn't have a sophisticated leasing strategy.
I would agree. What we often talk to our clients and companies that are interested in inviting us into their offices is we're not always concerned about the first decision. First decision meaning who should you do business with under what terms and conditions. But before we do that and lay that groundwork and foundation, we need to know what your second decision is. Meaning, what is your plan? Bring into the conversation your user group, the people that are going to be using the equipment and the technology, because the CFO sometimes makes decisions in a vacuum. And they need to find out, how is the user group going to use this equipment? What is their short and long-term plan? What is their contingency? You know, did they sign a long-term agreement with a vendor where they get free upgrades, or they've committed to replacing the equipment? And you want to make sure the lease term and the lease provisions are in compliance with the other plan. Do you plan on returning it and upgrading it? And so these are the different things that the CFO can benefit by bringing in their users to help him formulate and structure the right lease documents.
And it's not only that this is a good strategy, it's that there's some pretty nasty things out there that do happen, even though one has read through the lease.
Correct. So, yeah, cause now there's one thing about reading it. For instance, one of the most unusual trigger clauses in a lease is the commencement date. One would think that if we commence the lease today, the 14th, and we sign a monthly lease agreement, that our payments would be due on the 14th of every month for as long as we've agreed to lease the equipment. What one may not know is that, with rare exception, operating leases today have a clause that says the lease will begin the first day of the following month. Some even say, and it's a smaller subset of lessors, some will even say the first day of the following calendar quarter. So let's go with the most common scenario, the first day of the following month. So today's the 14th. The lease is going to commence on 10-1. That's the first day of the following month. During that period of time, those 17 days, you're going to pay us prorated rent. So let's just pick something easy. Say it's a $3,000 a month rent. So it's $100 a day when you think about it on a prorated basis. So you're going to owe me $1,700 for this month, and then you're going to pay me $3,000 a month for however months we have agreed to. But what the customer doesn't realize is this first payment, that $1,700, that's interest only. There's no principal in that first payment. And depending on how long your lease term is, that interest-only payment can range from 15 to almost 50% interest rate.
Oh, my goodness. And that's a pretty standard way of doing business.
I would say that is industry standard, is the first day of the following month.
And that means that you're going to be carrying that principal there and paying interest on it.
You'll be paying the first payment is interest only with no principal.
Right.
Yes, and the interest is calculated on a prorated basis, which will typically be in the 20 to 30% range. Could be low as 15, but as high as 50.
And you're going to be paying on paying interest on that part of the principal that you didn't pay for those 17 days.
Yes, and to put that into context, most companies, if they were to borrow from their bank for a short-term period, you know, may borrow at prime plus one, maybe prime plus two, prime plus a half. You know, so they're looking more at, you know, 5% money. Even a small business can borrow at 6% today, as opposed to 15 to 50%. So you could save 1, 2, 3% of the transaction size just by negotiating that one sentence in your document.
And who knows to do that? How many CFOs have been trained to do that?
I would probably say a very small number because, you know what, it sounds fair and reasonable. If I were to be moving into my office space in the middle of the month, I would expect that the landlord, unless I negotiated otherwise, is going to charge me for being in the space. They're going to charge me for those 17 days. So it seems reasonable. The difference is a lease is typically 3 to 5 years. Yes, some of them go 7 years and longer, but the traditional equipment lease is 3 to 5 years in term. The vast majority of equipment under lease is purchased at the end of term by the lessee. A small percent is actually returned to the leasing company. So there is an ownership aspect to equipment leases versus real estate, commercial real estate, unless you're doing a sale leaseback or buying your own headquarters. You know, you don't anticipate owning the building of which you're one of many tenants.
So if I were concerned about the quality of life of people in Orange County, and, you know, I was looking at what large, medium to large businesses do and where they're vulnerable, and I wanted to protect them from that vulnerability, especially in terms of leasing, which from listening to you could be a significant hit to their bottom line, I would want to spread this word far and wide that at least find a leasing expert who is not tied to the lessor to look through this leasing document, wouldn't I?
I would think that would be the first place. That's how we vet leasing companies. When our clients say, look, Jay, here are 3 to 5 to 10 leasing companies that we're contemplating. Before we get into the RFP and structuring and everything, can you vet them for us? Here's their financial statements. Here's their brochures, which are all nice and glossy. And I tell them, you know what I want? I want their master lease because this will tell me everything I need to know about that particular leasing company. If that leasing company needs for you to give them 180-day prior written notice on a 2 or 3 year lease, that tells me that they plan on renewing you. Because guess what? If you're in a 2 or 3 year lease and you got to give them 6 months prior notice, that means you need to be making equipment decisions probably a few months before that so you know which end-of-term option you want. So that means a year in advance on a 2 or 3 year lease, you're going to be looking at a change. Most customers aren't ready for that. Once they do a lease, they put it in their filing cabinet and they forget about it. And, I'm looking for a leasing company who's looking for 30, 60, maybe 90 days notice at the onset. Do they have these one-year auto-renewal clauses? That tells me a lot about the character and the goals of the leasing company.
Wow. All right. So now, one more question. Is it safe to assume that most of these medium to large companies have their entire leasing portfolio secured and organized in one filing cabinet or in one place?
I would say that would be the exception to the rule. Every now and then we run into a company, particularly law firms, that do a good job with document retention, legal library. But in general, mid to large size corporations have multiple signers. So it's just not the CFO. It could be a CFO, a treasurer, anyone with a VP title or controller, a plant manager, many, many people within a company that execute leases. And there's rarely a centralized repository for documents. companies are getting better today. Technology is much better at scanning into databases, but I would say leases have not fallen into the category of centralizing the documents and putting it into a software package that analyzes the economics, that tracks notice requirements, budgets for end-of-term options, notifies the stakeholders that a lease is going to be coming up. You know, are you thinking about your next decision? I think that's an area that is largely overlooked by corporate America.
Well, let me ask you a question, Jay. You seem to be a fairly easygoing guy. I don't see you coming in and trying to sell somebody with a strong arm. Is there a downside to a CEO asking you to come in and take a look at their leasing portfolio? I mean, is there a way that they're going to lose money by asking you to come in and look at some of their leasing practices?
We very rarely ask for an advance fee prior to meeting. It's just not in our DNA. We prefer to meet with people first without the thought or pressure of doing business together. In fact, you know, during this courtship period, you know, we want to get to know them and them to get to know us, because trust at one point needs to be earned. And we want our customers to feel comfortable with who we are and not to be hard-pressed into having to sign an engagement, putting up advance monies. After all, when they ultimately need us, it's because they didn't have the proper vetting process for this. So, no, that won't happen unless we have to travel. And I think it's reasonable that we share in that expense. If they want to cover our travel expense, I think that's fair.
But a CEO has only a downside by not talking to you, because there could be some very unexpected, very unfortunate financial surprises.
We see this a lot. I'm sorry.
It sounds to me like what you do when people ask you in is you help protect them from those unfortunate, incredibly expensive financial surprises.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. And if $100,000, if $500,000, if $1 million in unplanned expense is material to a C-level executive, then we should be talking.
How would they get in touch with you?
The simplest way is to call me. My number is 949-862-0555.
I'm the extension 102. Tell me again, what's the number?
I'm sorry?
The number again?
949-862-0555, extension 102.
Okay. Wonderful. Well, listen, thanks for being here, and thanks for the horror stories. And I'm glad to hear that you are helping companies to rationalize their leasing strategies and helping to pick up and put some protection around some of the things that they might have done without knowing it that make them vulnerable.
Well, Will, I've enjoyed our time together, and thank you for your interest in introducing this service to your audience.
Great. Super. Thanks a lot, Jay. We've been talking to Jay Zeinfeld, CEO and founder of Optimus Group, who does a lot of work to help medium to large companies rationalize, protect themselves from sometimes predatory leasing companies, and sometimes just because they signed a lease and they didn't know exactly what was going to happen. So that's where we are, up and down the 405 today, looking at companies, trying to help them focus on what's going to strengthen their company and help them to thrive here in Orange County, because that's, we know who creates jobs. It's the companies who are in Orange County that are going to create the jobs that are going to help us move forward and thrive in this new economy. So, from the Pilgrim on the 405, I enjoyed being with you. Look forward to talking with you again next week.
You've just taken a trip into the wilderness with your own personal guide, the Pilgrim on the 405. As he walks you through the strange new world of the 21st century economy. Only on octalkradio.net.